What if I told you that the blueprint for the most advanced, AI-driven zero-waste industrial ecosystem on Earth isn't sitting on a desk somewhere in Silicon Valley?
Right, and it's definitely not being built in Germany either.
Exactly. It is actually being deployed right now on like 7,000 acres of raw, completely off-grid land in the Kabong district of Uganda.
It is wild.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking you into a stack of truly fascinating sources. We got our hands on confidential business plans, global compliance reports, and these high-level strategic framework documents detailing something called the Eco-Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, and it's a huge structural shift.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack the ultimate playbook for how the Global South is actively bypassing Western industrial models altogether. They're building completely sovereign, highly profitable, circular economies.
Right, because for the last century, traditional industrialization relied on this very centralized linear model. You know, you extract resources here, you ship them over there to be processed using this massive, fragile national power grid, and then you just sort of dump the waste somewhere else.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. But what these documents reveal is that developing nations are just leapfrogging that entire fragile system.
And whether you are an investor tracking global ESG trends, or maybe someone keeping a close eye on where AI is actually manipulating the physical world, or, you know, you're just fiercely curious about the future of international development, this deep dive is going to fundamentally change how you view the very concept of infrastructure.
It definitely changed my perspective.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to really understand how these nations are outmaneuvering the legacy grids of the West, we first have to look at the mechanical architecture making it all possible.
Right, the hardware.
Yeah, the sources refer to this technology package as the sovereign stack.
So to grasp the mechanics of the sovereign stack, we really have to look at the primary architect in these documents, which is a company called Dereticular EIP Solutions, or DES.
Okay.
And they don't operate like a traditional construction firm pouring concrete for empty factory shells. Their whole business model is deploying what they term economic operating systems.
To establish these green special economic zones, right?
You got it. It's this crazy fusion of heavy industry and enterprise software.
I want to break down that fusion because honestly, the hardware side alone is intense. The foundational piece they drop into these zones is called the Nexus Core.
Right. And you have to think of the Nexus Core less like a traditional power plant and more like the life support system on a deep space probe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is the centralized brain of the industrial park. It's designed to process its own survival metrics entirely in a vacuum. It controls the localized energy generation and the water filtration.
Meaning it doesn't even need to plug into a host nation's utility grid.
Exactly. It is completely standalone.
And then they pair that physical core with something called the intranet canopy. And from what I read, this isn't just like stringing up a few routers in an office.
Oh, not at all.
The documents detail how this hardware literally blankets the entire multi-thousand acre zone in high-speed, monetized Wi-Fi. I mean, they are constructing a totally self-contained digital environment before the first factory is even built.
Which brings us to the software layer that actually governs all those physical assets, right?
Right.
The Rios Sovereign Cloud Suite.
Oh, yeah.
So Rios acts as the local internet service provider, the cloud storage array, and the operational dashboard, all rolled into one system.
That's a lot of power in one system.
It is. And the DES strategic framework explicitly states their engineering goal here. They want to transition communities from linear fragility.
Meaning relying on those distant, unstable national grids where, like, a storm three towns over shuts down your entire assembly line.
Exactly. Moving away from that to what they call spherical resilience.
So they generate their own baseline power, process their own water, and route their own data locally. I mean, it genuinely sounds like they are dropping a plug-and-play SimCity out of a shipping container right into the savannah. You boot it up, and boom, instant industrial economy.
That's the pitch, yeah.
But I have to push back on the labor realities here. When I was reading through the Ryo software capabilities, the system relies heavily on a fleet of AI called OpenClaw Industry Agents.
The AI foreman, essentially.
Right. And the business plan claims these AI agents automate like 70% of the park's physical administration, maintenance scheduling, and resource allocation.
Yeah, it's a massive amount of automation.
So if an AI foreman is doing all the operational heavy lifting, doesn't this entirely defeat the whole purpose of industrializing a developing nation? I mean, you're just replacing a massive source of local blue-collar jobs with a server rack.
That is the immediate tension in any automated infrastructure project, for sure. And it's a vulnerability the DAS business plan actually acknowledges up front.
So how do they fix it?
They attempt to mitigate that by deploying what the documents classify as human software right alongside the physical stack.
Yeah, I saw that term. They deploy an Academy franchise on site. But I mean, I'm skeptical. Training a few dozen locals to read diagnostic iPads while an AI runs the actual factory floor, that doesn't replace the thousands of manual labor jobs a traditional textile mill would bring to a region.
Sure.
Are they actually building a middle class here? Or just training a handful of tech admins to babysit the robots?
Well, what's fascinating here is the curriculum detailed in those Academy franchise documents. It suggests they are aiming for something much higher up the value chain.
Really? Like what?
They are training locals to become sovereign systems architects, or SSAs. This isn't just basic IT support. The training involves really complex systems engineering, microgrid load balancing, algorithmic governance.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the economic thesis here is that by automating the manual labor, you force the local workforce to transition immediately into a knowledge economy. You are creating a highly skilled local governance class.
Capable of independently maintaining and even exporting this tech, rather than just keeping them reliant on low-wage physical labor.
Exactly. They want the locals to own the knowledge.
So the goal is to prevent the whole project from becoming this black box that only foreign engineers know how to operate. That actually transitions us perfectly, because this cutting-edge sovereign stack, the microgrids, the local cloud servers, the AI agents, it can't just operate in a vacuum.
No, it needs rules of engagement.
Right. It needs a regulatory framework to actually trade its goods globally, which raises a huge logistical question. How are different governments actually writing the laws to accommodate these autonomous eco-industrial parks?
The sources include a really brilliant comparative analysis of this global compliance landscape. It's essentially a race among emerging markets right now to attract international green capital.
And Vietnam is sort of the benchmark there, right?
Yeah, Vietnam serves as the current regulatory benchmark in the documents.
And what really stood out to me about Vietnam is how aggressively they've codified the digital monitoring. Like, it isn't voluntary at all.
Not at all. Vietnamese national law mandates that at least 20% of the enterprises within any industrial park must implement strict resource efficiency and cleaner production metrics.
Right.
They also require 25% of the total land to be dedicated purely to ecological green space. But, you know, the mechanical enforcement is what's really fascinating.
The telemetry stuff.
Exactly. They require mandatory digital telemetry. Mm-hmm. Every single factory floor must send real-time emissions data directly to a centralized government cloud.
So if a processing plant spikes its sulfur output or, like, dumps untreated water at 2.0 a.m., the central government's API just flags it instantly. There's no waiting around for some annual environmental audit.
Right. The data doesn't lie.
What about South Africa? Because their legal framework takes a completely different angle based on their geography.
Yeah. South Africa's regulations are heavily engineered around severe water scarcity. So their industrial parks are legally forced to demonstrate strict closed-loop water strategies.
And mechanically, what does that mean?
It means effluent water for manufacturing has to be treated to near potable standards right on site, and then continuously cycled back into the facility's cooling towers or processing lines.
Wow, so no water leaves the system.
Pretty much. But they also enforce a very unique socioeconomic integration.
Oh, the post-consumer recycling mandates?
Correct. The parks are incentivized, and in some zones completely required, to purchase post-consumer recyclable materials directly from the surrounding informal township economies.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it creates this shadow commodity market, tying the high-tech industrial zone directly to the financial uplift of the local population.
So they're actively tailoring the macro laws to the micro realities on the ground. And then when we look at Latin America, Colombia is positioned as the leader, but their focus is entirely on biodiversity and market access.
Colombia mandates the physical construction of biological corridors. And this isn't just, you know, planting a row of trees around the fence line.
Right, it's way more involved.
It requires deep geospatial mapping to ensure that the industrial footprint does not sever natural wildlife migration patterns or watershed flows. And they are doing this for a highly strategic economic reason.
Because they are positioning these specific eco-industrial parks as low-carbon export zones aimed squarely at the European Union.
Exactly. The EU has recently implemented incredibly strict ESG import regulations. They are effectively taxing products based on the carbon and deforestation footprint of their supply chains.
Right, the border taxes.
Yeah, so by legally mandating biological corridors and clean production at the source, Colombia's parks generate the exact digital traceability data required to automatically clear EU customs without facing those heavy tariffs.
They are essentially programming their infrastructure to just completely bypass international trade friction. That is so smart. Now, the final model the sources dissect is Ethiopia, which operates under a very different state-led command structure.
Yeah, Ethiopia focuses its industrial policy heavily on the textile and apparel sector, which is notoriously water-intensive and chemically toxic.
Really toxic.
So their core regulatory mechanism is the strict enforcement of zero liquid discharge, or ZLD plants.
I was looking at the mechanics of ZLD in the reports, and it is intense. You aren't just running the wastewater through a standard charcoal filter?
No, ZLD requires thermal evaporation and crystallization.
Wait, crystallization?
Yeah. You literally boil the effluent water down until the clean water vapor is captured and reused, and the chemical contaminants are reduced to a solid, dry salt cake.
Oh, wow.
It's a legal requirement in these Ethiopian parks that 90% or more of all industrial water is completely recycled, meaning practically zero liquid ever leaves the facility's pipes into the local environment.
That's incredible. If we synthesize all this, Vietnam's real-time APIs, South Africa's closed water loops, Colombia's supply chain tracing, and Ethiopia's crystallized waste, it becomes glaringly obvious that environmental compliance is just no longer a defensive strategy.
No, it's totally proactive now.
Right. It's not about avoiding a punitive fine for dumping chemicals in a river anymore.
And that is the pivotal insight of the entire global analysis. The fundamental nature of compliance has flipped from being punitive to being entirely generative.
Generative meaning it creates quantifiable financial yield. By proving they hit these extreme ecological metrics through immutable digital data, these sovereign parks prove their eligibility for high-margin carbon finance markets.
Exactly.
They unlock cheaper debt from global institutions and secure really lucrative access to heavily guarded Western markets. The eco part of the eco-industrial park isn't a PR stunt. It is the primary financial mechanism for capital acquisition.
It literally is the asset itself.
Okay. But writing a clever biological corridor law in Colombia is relatively easy compared to dropping this high-tech hardware into an environment with absolutely zero baseline grid stability.
Right. Physical reality is much harder.
Which is why Uganda's Project Umoja is the true acid test for this entire theory. We have the technology. We have the global rules. Let's look at what happens when they actually break ground.
Project Umoja, specifically the Kabong Smart Eco-Industrial Park or the Plasma Project. This is a $30 million joint venture between Agri Energy Uganda and Dare Reticular, encompassing 7,000 acres of raw land.
And the context here is vital. According to Uganda's own 2024 national guidelines included in the stack, previous attempts at building industrial parks in the country had a pretty dismal track record.
Yeah, they consistently failed.
Right, due to a lack of empirical site data prior to construction and their total reliance on the fragile national power grid. You simply cannot run a modern, globally competitive manufacturing sector if the power cuts out for 4 hours every single afternoon.
So they just completely abandoned the idea of connecting to the national grid at all. Which brings us to the deployment of the Rios Pilot Command Center.
This detail genuinely blew my mind. The operational manual for the Rios Command Unit, pulled straight from the engineering documents, essentially boils down to one instruction: put it in the sun.
I know. It is a ruggedized, self-contained, solar-powered edge computing unit.
Just a box in the dirt.
Basically. The moment you drop it onto the empty Kabon site on day one, it powers up, connects to low Earth orbit Starlink satellites, and just begins its work.
And what it does is remarkable. It doesn't send the data back to a server farm in Virginia. Because of the onboard edge computing, it processes environmental telemetry, topological maps, and solar irradiance locally in real time.
Yeah, the edge computing is key.
Before a single foundation is dug, this box generates an automated digital twin, a complete virtual simulation of the entire 7,000-acre environment. And it uses that simulation to run an extended cost-benefit analysis for the Ugandan government regulators, empirically proving the site's viability.
And once the simulation proves out, they have to build the actual power generation. And this is where the concept of industrial symbiosis becomes mechanical reality.
I'm stuck on the mechanics of this, so you have to walk me through it. The plan is to cultivate high-yield industrial hemp across the 7,000 acres, process the hemp for exportable oil and fiber, and then take the massive amount of agricultural waste, like the leftover stalks, and use it for power. Normally, agricultural waste on that scale is a massive logistical liability. It rots, it off-gasses methane, or you burn it and create terrible air quality. How does a single facility turn hemp waste into reliable baseline electricity?
They utilize a 210 tons per day plasma gasification unit. And it is crucial to understand that plasma gasification is not incineration. You're not burning the waste.
Okay, so what actually happens inside the chamber, though?
So you introduce the hemp waste into an oxygen-starved reactor, and you subject it to a plasma torch operating at roughly 5,000 degrees Celsius.
Wait, 5,000 degrees?
Yeah, essentially the surface temperature of the sun. Because there isn't enough oxygen for combustion, the waste doesn't burn. Instead, the intense heat just breaks the organic material apart at the molecular level.
That is wild.
It dissociates the chemical bonds, transforming the solid waste into a clean synthetic gas, or syngas. That syngas is then captured, filtered, and combusted to spin the turbines.
And that generates the power.
Right, generating 10, 11 megawatts of continuous clean electricity to run the factories.
That is incredible. And what about the solid byproduct of destroying it at that temperature?
The remaining inorganic material forms this vitrified slag, which in this agricultural context actually functions as biochar.
Okay, so a fertilizer.
Exactly. A highly porous, carbon-rich fertilizer. They take that byproduct and till it directly back into the 7,000 acres of soil to increase the yield of the next hemp crop. It is a completely closed, symbiotic loop.
The financials of this specific plasma deployment are also a major disruptor. The documents note that the historical industry benchmark for building a municipal plasma unit of this scale is somewhere between $27 million and $82 million.
Yeah, it's usually a bespoke, massive civil engineering project.
But DeRiticular is deploying their standardized modular unit for roughly $10 million. Because they are treating the power plant like a scalable server rack rather than a custom build, their ROI break-even drops to an unheard of 2 to 4 years.
Achieving a 4-year break-even on heavy power infrastructure in an emerging market just completely changes the risk calculus for institutional investors globally.
But I need to challenge the socio-political reality of this. You have a foreign-backed technology company coming in and locking down 7,000 acres of land in an energy-starved developing region of Uganda. To a vast majority of geopolitical observers, that immediately sets off alarm bells for corporate land grabbing.
The developers are hyper aware of that optic, and the risk management section of the Kabong business plan addresses it explicitly.
Oh, they do.
Yeah. The first layer of defense is transparency. Because the RIO system uses high-resolution GIS to map the land boundaries and logs the agreements on an immutable digital ledger, the local community has transparent proof of exactly what land is utilized and what isn't.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the physical mitigation is how they run the park. They operate in island mode.
Meaning they don't siphon power away from the host nation's grid?
Right, but it goes even further than that. Because the plasma unit generates 11 megawatts of power from the hemp waste, the park actually produces significantly more electricity than its own internal factories require.
So what do they do with the excess?
They sell that excess baseline power back to the local energy-starved Kabong microgrid. They integrate as a net provider of public utilities, stabilizing the local towns rather than extracting from them.
I see the logic, but I have to push back again. Selling power back to the grid sounds great on a spreadsheet. But if a private foreign-designed tech company effectively controls the physical power switch for an entire Ugandan district, doesn't that just replace dependence on a failing state grid with dependence on a corporate monopoly?
That's where the governance architecture we touched on earlier comes into play. The community doesn't just passively receive power. Through the local sovereign systems architects and the structure of the joint venture, local stakeholders actually maintain equity in the power generation itself.
Okay.
The operating system utilizes a decentralized framework, like a split ledger, which ensures that algorithmic voting rights over utility pricing and distribution are shared. It physically prevents the corporate operator from unilaterally shutting off the grid without local consensus.
So, what does this all mean? If this island mode template proves successful in Kabong, if you can truly drop a box in the sun, use edge computing to simulate the environment, grow hemp, plasma gasify the waste, and generate decentralized power with local equity, what happens when a company like this scales that model globally?
It completely rewrites the capital allocation model of international infrastructure and fundamentally disrupts how we view international aid.
Let's look at the financial flywheel detailed in Derriticular's 10-year pro forma. They outline an aggressive scaling plan, moving from 2 active park builds in year 1 to 445 active industrial zones globally by year 10.
That's a massive scale up.
It is. And when you look at the revenue breakdown in that 10th year, there is a radical inversion.
Right, because in the early years, their revenue is entirely CapEx driven. They make money selling the physical solar panels, the plasma units, the microgrids.
The hardware?
Yeah. But by year 10, the physical hardware sales are completely marginalized. SaaS software as a service and recurring data royalties from the Rios platform account for 44% of an estimated $213 million revenue stream.
And enterprise software operates at near 90% margins. By deploying the physical hardware at cost, Derriticular is effectively building a Trojan horse. Their ultimate goal is to own the industrial intranet of the Global South.
Exactly.
They want to hold the master license for the operating system that runs physical reality in emerging markets.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where the sources transition into the concepts of Node 7 and UN 2.0. This represents a huge paradigm shift in global capital deployment called Humanitarian Aid as a Service, or HAAS.
HAAS. Okay, for an audience used to tracking global investments, how does HAAS change the underlying economics of international aid?
So traditional international aid is almost entirely OPEX operating expenses. Global institutions appropriate massive budgets to buy consumables, you know, grain shipments, bottled water, temporary medical tents.
Right.
They fly them into a crisis zone, the supplies are consumed, and next year you have to spend the exact same OPEX budget again just to maintain the baseline. It yields zero long-term infrastructure.
Under the UN 2.0 framework, that capital allocation completely flips.
Precisely. Sovereign wealth funds, major NGOs, and development banks shift those OPEX budgets into CAPEX capital expenditures. Instead of buying temporary consumables, they underwrite the deployment of these permanent off-grid Rios command centers and plasma units.
Buying stability.
Right. They're effectively financing stability as a service. The industrial park generates its own power, purifies its own water, and creates a highly taxable local export economy.
The infrastructure generates an economic yield, which pays back the sovereign wealth fund while permanently uplifting the region.
Right.
You empower a community to black start its own economy from zero.
Yeah.
This ties perfectly into the UNDP Signal Studio framework mentioned deep in the reports. These autonomous parks act as signal scanners, feeding local economic data, agricultural yields, and grid stability metrics back into a global foresight system.
Which is incredibly valuable data.
And the UNDP framework poses a critical question for the next decade. Will energy poverty become digital poverty?
In the modern economy, they are identical. If a region doesn't have reliable electricity, its citizens cannot participate in the global digital economy. By providing sovereign, decentralized power paired with localized cloud servers, these parks ensure that energy poverty doesn't permanently lock these nations out of the digital future.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. By merging AI administration, plasma gasification, and CapEx-driven aid models, the Global South isn't just catching up to the West. They aren't just building slightly better versions of our old factories.
No, they are playing a completely different game.
They are becoming the primary laboratory for the world's most advanced circular economies. Because they don't have to tear down a century of legacy power lines and entrenched monopolies, they are building resilient, decentralized systems from scratch. Systems that the West is going to have to carefully study and eventually license as our own centralized aging grids continue to buckle under the strain of climate events and power-hungry data centers.
It is the ultimate reversal of the industrial flow, turning historical aid recipients into the vanguard of sustainable infrastructure.
All right, to synthesize everything we've unpacked today, we started by looking at why the traditional linear factory model is practically obsolete. We dissected the mechanics of the sovereign stack from the spacecraft-like Nexus Core to the knowledge economy transition of the Academy franchise.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. We navigated the complex global compliance laws, exploring how biological corridors and zero liquid discharge plants turn ecological data into generative financial assets. And we saw all of this theory hit the dirt in Uganda, where edge computing and plasma gasification are aiming to upend the OPEX model of humanitarian aid.
It forces a total reevaluation of what capital can achieve in emerging markets.
It really does. The definition of an infrastructure investment has permanently expanded. For you listening, whether you are analyzing macro capital flows, assessing the physical deployment of enterprise AI, or just watching geopolitical power shifts, the takeaway is unavoidable.
It's all about decentralization now.
Exactly. The future of heavy industry belongs to decentralized, circular ecosystems that possess the hardware to generate their own power and the software to cryptographically secure their own digital truth.
And as we close out today's deep dive, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder, something that begins to emerge when you read between the lines of these long-term deployment strategies.
Okay, what is it?
We've discussed the concept of a split ledger governance model, where a decentralized database requires both the corporate operator and the local community to cryptographically agree before major grid changes can occur.
Right, local consensus.
If these eco-industrial parks successfully operate in island mode for decades, generating their own independent baseline power, capturing and securing their own economic data on a split ledger, and automating their own daily administration via AI foreman, do these 7,000-acre zones eventually evolve into self-sustaining, technologically independent city-states?
Wow.
And if an algorithmically governed industrial park no longer relies on its host nation for power, water, or internet, how will that fundamentally redefine what a national border even means in the 21st century?
Think about that the next time you picture a factory.